Rachel Tolele, Ngāti Raukawa ki te Tonga, Ngāti Rārua, Ngāti Kuata, is the CEO of Kono, a family-owned Māori food and beverage producer and exporter. A seafood aficionado, her business, Yellow Brick Road, supplies seafood to restaurants around the country. She's a former US Trade Commissioner who sits on the Prime Minister's Business Advisory Council and chairs New Zealand's APEC Business Advisory Council. You might have also caught her on a Zoom chat with the PM over lockdown too, in April, I think it was, this year. She's with me now in the Wellington studio live. E te tuhine tēnā koe.
Mōrena ihoa.
Tēnā koe. Thank you so much for being a part of the program and for coming in. I know we dragged you away from Gisborne, so really good to have you on the program this morning. Look, let's start with how you got to be in the position that you're in now, particularly given the fact that I think you didn't know your whakapapa connections to Te Tauihu until like 2011. So how do you end up being the CEO of Connell?
I know. Sometimes I ask myself that question, actually. I think that came about because, for a start, Connell is owned by the families of Wakatū Incorporation. And Wakatū has an amazing number of succession programs. So we've really invested in bringing the whānau into the business and having us really form the structure and the fabric of what takes Wakatū forward. And I had been chatting to a girlfriend of mine, Karenza Johnston, who we were at university with. Actually, we think sometimes and laugh about the fact that we met in the wharepaku in the toilets at the marae. We were both there in our first year of law school, having a sort of minor freak out about what we were doing there and knowing no one. But, you know, we met all the way back then, and then in about 2010, we were chatting and she told me she was in the succession program, the associate director program for Wakatū. And I said to her, you know, we get those newsletters, we get that pānui. And she said to me, what do you mean? And I said, you know, they come, my dad gets them. And she said, well, you only get those if you're an owner. You're only an owner if you whakapapa to either Ngāti Rārua, Ngāti Kōta, Tiati Awa, or Ngāti Tama. So, like, which is it? And I said to her, well, like, I don't know. You're like, no, I'm Raukawa, hard. And that's how it came about. Then it just unfolded from there. And I think what we hadn't known, like, you know, a lot of people of our generation, our aunties and our kuia, you know, they were taking off to hui all over the countryside, seemingly for reasons unknown to us. And so my grandmother's sister, Kiripuai, she would be the one who was always tripping down to Te Tauihu. And we just didn't know. And it wasn't shared with us, so how would you? But all's been revealed now. Yeah. And I came into the succession program myself as an associate director for Wakatū in 2012, jumped on the board in 2014 for Kono, and by the end of 2015 was sitting in the CEO position, and Kono bought Yellow Brick Road, which at the time was my business.
Yeah. Was there any trepidation in being a part of, and Wakatū has had a very storied history, 1970, obviously with Karenza being involved, is a very successful whānau company, right? Was there any trepidation from you moving into a role like that, being involved so directly, even though you were on the board, being so involved so directly as a CEO of a company that was a part of a Māori-owned entity, I suppose?
There definitely was, but I think it might be a bit of an emo of my professional life, is that I tend to say yes to most things unless they're, you know, really inadvisable or, you know, illegal. I tend to say yes to most things because you never know what you might learn. You never know the oftentimes the value you can add to a certain space. And I think over the last, say, 20 years of my career, everything had built me for that moment. Mm-hmm. So I had experienced New Zealand Trade and Enterprise and working in New Zealand and then offshore in the States. I'd set up my own company and worked in the seafood space and loved it. And so I had been a Māori person in business, but really you trust the universe in a way that it puts you where you're supposed to be at any given moment. And then to have the opportunity to be part of a Māori and whānau-owned business and my own whānau, you know, I couldn't believe my luck, really. I thought that was a real gift. And once in there, it dawned on me, yes, gift and opportunity, but enormous responsibility, which I think makes you perform to even higher degrees.
What are the fundamental values of Wakatū that drive Kono?
The ones that really, we have a number, the same way that other organisations might, you know, in Māori organisations, we love to say that we've got all the tangas covered, and we do, and for good reason. So, whanaungatanga, manaakitanga, kaitiakitanga, Pono is one, you know, that real truth and integrity and saying, you know, telling people what you're going to do and then actually doing it and having truth and integrity to what you do. The one that I love, Ngā Kōhihiko, is the one that really gets me jazzed. You know, are we fit for purpose? Are we ready for the future journey? Are we evolving ourselves every minute of every day so we can perform to the best of our abilities?
How do you evolve yourself now, given the environment globally that we're in at the moment with COVID and our geographic isolation, particularly for Aotearoa, that some would say limits our ability to be able to do business going forward now? How do you embody and actualise Ngā Kōhihiko for Kōnō now?
I think this is its golden moment. I think
really?
I do. I think that COVID has opened the door to and forced us to really think about how do you work your way through what is almost global debris is a bit, you know, extreme in the description of what's happening. But really, economies around the world at varying times and in varying degrees are imploding. And so how do you step your way through that? You need to turn on a dime. You need to be ready. You need to have the ability to be nimble. And that's what it gives us. So where I think that comes from, though, is your clarity over who you are and why you do the things you do. So there's no other option than to push forward. You know, and I think that Māori generally are built for survival. You know, we simply wouldn't be here if we hadn't had that gene and we don't have that hardwiring, that makeup. And so this is another version of that. Mm. And so you take a breath, compose yourself, grab hold even more tightly to those values that anchor you, and then you move forward. And I think that what I've seen over the last several months is that Māori thinking, Māori values, that our way of being is a place and a space and a sentiment that people have been drawn to.
Mm.
Because I think there's a calmness in the way that we move through really volatile situations. And there's a determined nature to the way that we conduct ourselves because we're sure of where we've been.
Mm.
And that gives us the surety over where we're going.
Do you think that gives us a competitive advantage, particularly for businesses like Kono, as we start to re-energise, re-evolutionise the way that we're going to be doing business as a country going forward? Is that our competitive advantage vis-a-vis any other business in Aotearoa?
Yes. I know, you know, like I would say that because I'm wildly biased, but yeah. I actually do think it's the case. I think that we are wholly unique. I think that not only in Aotearoa but around the world, people are looking for partners who show authenticity and are clear about themselves, who have heritage and story and depth and meaning. And people want to associate with those kinds of ideas and emotions because they resonate with them in times of trouble. So they want to feel that they're with partners who will be here for the long term. And, you know, our chairman will... Paul will joke that you can pick the phone up in 5 years or 50 years or 500 years, somebody will answer it. And I think that's really reassuring to people around the world when they do business with us. And we go out of our way to look for people who have aligned value sets to ours because we know that that's when the magic happens, when you align yourself with people who think and feel like you.
Yeah. And that has happened since March this year. You've been getting those phone calls, or indeed you've been ringing and people have been picking up the calls from you.
There has been less of the new phone calls because I think people are reeling a little bit from what's been happening to them. So I wouldn't want to be so Pollyanna as to say all of a sudden we're, it's a moth to a flame scenario. It's definitely not that. But I do think with the partners that we do have and we've had them for a long time, it's taken our relationship deeper because I'm a big believer in servant leadership and knowing people in order to serve them. And the better we know our partners, you can feel when they are stressed or when they're in pain or when they're really feeling the pinch. So in the States, not only are they dealing with COVID, but they've had Black Lives Matter and civil unrest, and then they have elections coming. And so there's a lot on their plate. They've got fires over in the West Coast. So all of these things combined put stresses on their business and then our relationship with them. So you can only support them through that.
How do you work, though, with, let's use the United States, who have become really isolationist in their view for leadership that they currently have, and therefore will move to even more protectionist kind of approaches and therefore potentially cut places like us out, cut Kono out? How do you deal with that? What do you do in that situation? How do you work with that?
It's an incredibly difficult risk to manage. And so when COVID did take place, we sat and thought about what are the real threats to our business? And we can largely manage because the how do you get into this market, this restaurant scene is closed, and so where do you pivot to and how do you actually move product through into any given market. The things that really challenge us are the geopolitical threats and risks to us. I mean, we're tiny. New Zealand is tiny. Kono is, in the global scheme of things, microscopic. And we are at the whim of these giants, full stop. So China is one of our biggest trading partners. The States is one of our biggest trading partners. It might be that you can't have two best friends as the world moves forward. But that is the purpose of some of the other work I do with, you mentioned the APEC Business Advisory Council, with ABAC. You know, we're big, strong supporters of the WTO and having a rules-based trading environment that we all enjoy the benefits of. So we work double time to lean into that structure and ensuring that it remains strong.
How is that progressing, APEC? I mean, I know we're hosting it in 2021. How's it going?
How does that go when no one can come to your party?
Exactly.
innovatively is what I would say. And APEC is a little bit different from the part that I'm charged with looking after, Business Council. So ABAC is three people from every one of the 21 economies who represent business. They're placed there by the leader. So in our case, myself and our other two members were placed there by Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern. So you really are representing the business voice to APEC. Next year, we're all online. It's my first time chairing. I don't really know everyone who's around the table very well or now around their computers very well. So it is an exercise in bringing together great minds from either tourism or MFAT or NZTE to help us create New Zealand experiences so the APEC economies can feel like they are engaging with New Zealand, but it's all online.
Yeah.
So you just have to be a little tricky about how that happens. But the agenda itself, the work program, is really important to those of us who are in business and who are working internationally.
How do you continue to observe things like manaakitanga, which is a very Māori thing, obviously, and a key value of Wakatū and also of Kono, because it's a big part of the role that you're going to have to undertake with ABAC, right? So how do you make that a practical kind of thing online?
So I think the only way I can do it is as me. Yeah. You know, I can't emulate any other kind of person, chair, sentiment. So I always open in te reo. And I will always share whakatauki with, these other 21 economies. And I will always try to bring it back to who we are as a people. And they will recognise that will manifest itself in their minds in different ways, which is great. But bringing the Indigenous conversation into the ABAC work programme, and I know that APEC is doing the same, that's really, really important because it empowers Indigenous economies around the world. So if there's one thing next year outside of WTO and food security and so forth that we advance, it will be greater recognition of Indigenous economies and the role that they play within their respective economies. Also, we might do things like, we might send them like a box of food. So when they get together next year in their own economies, they might be wearing Allbirds and drinking a bottle of Kono wine. So there are things that you can do that bring it home to them.
No, koha's important, right? It's a big part of the mahi that you do, a big part of Wakatū as well. You said your playbook is, I think I've got this right, safety, sovereignty and regeneration. What's the play-by-play on that? How do you make that real?
So I think that was, I did write that. I got really swept up during lockdown and clearly I had a lot of time on my hands because it all just came flying out into this article that I wrote for the spin-off about that. And it was, for me, it was about we have this moment and everyone's talked about this moment of pause and what you do with it after COVID. And mine was generally what happens after these really transformational events in history is that people get more separated and people get separated from what they know and they get separated from their way of life. My kōrero in that piece was actually we've been there. Māori have been there. We felt that. We've done that and we came back from it. But actually where we sit at the moment is that we are on every debilitating statistic you can put your finger on, like pick a list you don't want to be on, and we're knocking it out of the park. Ill health, suicide, incarceration, and so on and so forth. So for me, this golden moment is let's make sure our people are safe and let's empower them. So that's the safety part. The sovereignty part is how do we empower people to make the decisions for themselves and their whānau and their community and their hapū. And you saw it through the, what do you call them?
Iwi border controls.
Correct, yes. You know, where we did those sorts of things because we knew that we were right about it and we knew how to look after our own people. So that's the sovereignty part. So giving up some of the control from, say, central government or even local government to people to look after their communities. And then regeneration is, and then where do you go with all of that goodness? So let's just not have it be a moment in time that passes, because I think COVID showed us that big problems can be dealt with very quickly. Homelessness got dealt with almost in a relative instant. So if we know where the problems are, let's not shy away from the fact that we can genuinely fix those.
How do you retain an intergenerational approach? I think Waikato has a 500-year plan to Paitawhiti.
Yeah.
How do you retain that, given you have all these peaks and troughs, COVID being one of them, you know, global financial crisis, GFC 2007, 2008? How do you retain that focus on that long-term plan, that intergenerational approach that Waikato has, given what we have right now?
I think it's the answer, actually. That's how you maintain it. If you have an intergenerational perspective, and our 500-year plan isn't a plan per se so much as it is maybe even a behavioural doctrine, which, you know, sounds a bit Jerry Maguire-ish, but it is. but it does force you to think about what are the decisions you make today and how do they allow for a prosperous future for our moko and their moko and so on and so forth. So the number is 500, but it could be 55,000. You know, it's a metaphor for being a good ancestor. And so whilst that's the punchline, we now think about what are the actual steps you take between here and there. So we have five po that have to work synchronistically in order for us to know we're succeeding. It's, you know, papa whenua and whānau and taiao and pūtia and in that respect. So I think that if, and this is what I love about being part of a Māori organisation, is that you can ride the waves because you're in it for the long haul and you're not based solely on the bottom line as you might expect in any other commercial business. So yes, we measured commercially as any other business is, but we're driven by wholly social imperatives. And so one is simply a means to another end.
And there's a very boisterous community that you have to report to. It must be fascinating, AGMs, because you're right, they keep an eye on the bottom line, but they also hold you to account on that 500-year plan, right?
They do.
Which is a fascinating thing I've found in
my love it. It's the best. You know, it is. I mean, I'm lucky because I get to do the sort of fun, sparkly things, you know, the wine, and we've just bought a craft brewery, and these sorts of things are all really interesting. And we've got 4,000 owner families at Waikato, and they are like the greatest ambassadorial army you could ever hope for. But you're right. They do hold you to account. So they have over the years, you know, the questions that come really force our thinking about, are you doing that in the right way? Like, really, what is your relationship to water?
Yeah.
And how are you going to manage that? And, you know, what's your plan in the space of being good kaitiaki? Because if we say we are, like, show me what we're doing. And so that's our present obsession, is to become a tikanga-led regenerative agriculture business by 2030, and that's huge, terrifying, but really exciting, the tikanga-led part in particular.
I want to talk about Waikato, particularly the decision from the Supreme Court in 2017. And it was decided that the Crown owes a duty to the Māori owners of the Nelson Tents Reserve and Occupation Reserves to preserve and protect the land. Has this been resolved? Where are we at?
Let's call it a work in progress. So no, it hasn't been. So we did win that case, and it was, you know, life changing. The process has been literally life changing for the people who have been involved intimately. And I recall really distinctly being in the court the day when Dame Shana Elias read the judgment, and she's so calm in its delivery, and I had to think, did we just win? Like, what just happened there? We just won. And there were a lot of tears, and it was incredibly emotional because it has been such a long journey, and, you know, people have passed in the process, but we were there in the moment. I'm getting goosebumps right now. Anyway, so the direction was back to the High Court for remedies, and no, it hasn't happened. And I think what's challenging in that space is that whilst we work in this fantastic business within Kono, a huge amount of our families and our management and governance time is spent trying to rectify that wrong And so if we could simply resolve those issues, it would be a game changer for our whānau, but our businesses as well, because you could redirect that energy into, you know, really creating jobs and creating wealth for not only the families and for the business, but for te tauihu. You know, these are the sorts of things that are being held up, which could really unleash the potential of an entire country. And so work in progress. We hope it's progressed sooner rather than later.
Has at the very basic point, lands that are a part of the trust or should be, well, are a part of the trust, have they been protected? Have those lands been kept in place as a part of the trust so that they can, that those issues can be resolved? Or is there a threat potentially that those lands could be sold off in some way, shape or form, thus causing a further grievance?
Well, that's the position we find ourselves in now, is trying to preclude the Crown from actually moving on land. I mean, there's not a lot of productive land that might actually be part of that return parcel. Yeah. And so where there are pockets of it, we're endeavouring to have those held on to by the Crown.
Yeah.
And we have recently had a case with some ACC property that they were trying to dispose themselves of, and our point being just taihō, because that could be part of the future settlement, so let's not rush into you doing that. So those are the conversations. So we're now not only fighting the battle of what are the remedies, we're fighting the battle of things like ACC.
This has been 3 years now, though. I mean, we're into an election cycle now. Do you expect at the very least some action in the next few months, particularly after an election? Because there should be. It's 3 years since the decision now. It's one electoral term.
Well, look, from your lips to somebody's ears, Julian, because...
You're closer than me to the Prime Minister, apparently.
Expectations. So. Yes. Well, I wasn't until right now.
That's true.
Yeah. Look, I hope so. That's our endeavour. We're ready. Yeah. We are poised. We are ready. We've had the judgment. We know what the instruction has been. So we hope that it is sooner rather than later.
It's a fascinating story in your journey, you know, going from law at Victoria University to where you are. Do you kind of take stock sometimes and think, man, this is out of it?
I do sometimes. And I think I was telling somebody a story the other day where a friend and I started a market together, and I had Yellow Brick Road at the time, so I was selling fish there. So you're down there every Sunday morning, filleting gurnard and opening oysters and general banter with market punters. And now I see some of those people around board tables and some quite influential board tables, and you can see that they're looking at you. And I've had the odd person say to me, "Are you the fish lady?" You know, they're like, "Did you sell me my tarakihi?" Yeah. So, well, yes, I did. And yeah, you can see them really actively try to work out how one leads to another. But I love that. It's great. You know, that those are really formative years of having your own business and having be the person who licks the stamps and packs the boxes and delivers the fish and does all of those sorts of things. It makes it much easier to do the things you do now because you've really sweated in that way.
I remember I caught up with you in Corenza, it was last year, I think, at Ngaitau, actually, and I felt just, there was an infectious kind of optimism and positivity that you both had. Is that reflected in other work that you're doing, like the Business Council and ABAC and those other things? Are you feeling the same kind of vibe of that positivity and optimism despite what's happening at the moment globally?
Some conversations are like that. You know, I think that I generally feel optimistic, and I think that probably does. I'm really lucky and fortunate to be within Wakatū. So in our senior leadership team, 4 of the 6 senior leaders are whānau. And we work in an environment of really high love and trust, and we sprint. Like, you know, you think Corenza and I are optimistic. Mariana Stevens, who's part of our crew, like, she's off the planet. She's the poster child for optimism and energy. And so so you have that. And if you're surrounded by people like that all of the time, you cannot help but be, you're just drowning in good. And so you take that out into the other places that you work within. And sometimes it sticks. You know, you can't have that all the time because certain environments are harder than others. But by and large, if you're always coming back to that energy, then you can top up and refuel and go again. So
I have to tell you, my stomach's been grumbling because every time you talk about kono and Yellow Brick Road, I get hiyakai. Hey, look, thank you so much for coming in. I know, as I say, you had to do a bit of a dash from Gisborne to be with us live in the studio, so I really do appreciate it. I wish you all the best. I know, you know, you're one of our up-and-coming, actually not even up-and-coming anymore. You're one of our business leaders. That's been reflected in awards, particularly Māori Business Awards and the like. I just wish you all the best.
Thank you so much.
We had a text actually from someone, I can't remember the name, who said, when's the pavilion party? I don't know what that means.
I don't know what it means either. I've got no idea what you're talking about at all. It's probably from Che Wilson.
Kia ora hoa. Thank you very much for coming in. Really appreciate it. That was Rachel Tolele. She is, of course, the CEO of Konor.